Hello, and welcome to the Writers and Illustrators of the Future podcast. This is John Goodwin, your host. This podcast is dedicated to the aspiring writer or artist and will provide inspiration and tips from top professionals in the field, along with contest winners and a few surprise guests. Today, we are speaking with Writers of the Future 33 winner with his short story, Adramelech, Sean Patrick Hazlett. Hello, Sean.
Hi, John. How you doing?
I'm doing great. That was one spooky story. It's just like the guy really was evil. That the little catchphrase in front of the book for your story was, "Some devils are as old as a dream and more evil than men can imagine."
Yeah, I'm actually surprised at how dark that story turned out. you look at the end and like that was really dark. I think I remember there was an event that we had. It was a signing event at a Barnes & Noble, and I started reading the first paragraph in a public reading, and as I was reading it, I'm like, man, this is really dark. Like that story subsequently I think sold two more times as a reprint in Best Hardcore Horror. Volume 3, and then it sold to another outfit also. So that's just one of those stories that you do some research, historical research, which you look at the demon Adramelech, so there's a lot of elements of that historical Semitic demon, but there's also part of what you do as a creator and give him a little bit of your own. So there's, the creepy part about that story is at the end, there's a bit of like kind of child sacrifice and things like that. But that's what that demon was known for, historically. So, but again, it's extremely, extremely dark. It's probably one of the darker stories I've ever written. And you don't really know what where those things come from. Sometimes you just start writing these things. The other thing that's interesting to note is that when I first submitted it, the story that won was actually shorter than the one that ultimately made the anthology. And the reason is that when I got the edits back from David Farland, he said, "Hey, if you want to add a little bit more, feel free to." And my first question is, I have a business background. It's like, how many words can I add, right? Because I know what the calculation per word is and all that good stuff. But it's, at the same time, you don't want to screw up the story,
right?
So I added maybe 1,000 more words, but it actually took the story up another level. So there's a scene in there where the protagonist is in a graveyard. And he's exhuming, a body, and the keeper of the graveyard, sees him, and he has this, ability to convey his soul to other people, right?
Yeah.
And then kind of take them over. So he's kind of stuck. Like, what does he do? And he ends up taking over, the guy's body, and then, throws the guy into a well, jumps into a well, and then leaves. And it's just like, I don't know where that came from, but it just made the story so much darker because what do you do in that situation? Because you're compelled to do something horrific, and then you're caught in that act, and the demon makes him do darker and darker things to prepare him for the ultimate thing at the end. And that's when there's the point of salvation, right? Where he sacrifices himself.
Right.
But he does it in a way that's not entirely satisfying, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he still is able to demonstrate the power of free will. And that's what that story is ultimately about. The game is rigged against that particular protagonist, but in the end, he is able to make, not the best choice, but the most, the choice that maximizes that expression of free will.
Yeah. Okay, now, having talked about that story you went with, I'm now going to read your bio so we can try to see how did this amazing biography of a person come out with just if there's any insight into that. So Sean Patrick Hazlett is an Army veteran, speculative fiction writer and editor, and finance executive in the San Francisco Bay Area. He holds an AB in history and BS in electrical engineering from Stanford University and a master in public policy from the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, where he won the 2006 Policy Analysis Exercise Award for his work on policy solutions to Iran's nuclear weapons program under the guidance of future Secretary of Defense Ashton B. Carter. He also holds an MBA from the Harvard Business School, where he graduated with second-year honors. As a cavalry officer serving in the elite 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment, he trained various Army and Marine Corps units for war in Iraq and Afghanistan. While at the Army's National Training Center, he became an expert in Soviet doctrine and tactics. He has also published a Harvard Business School case study on that 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment and how it exemplified a learning organization. Sean is a 2017 winner of the Writers of the Future contest. Over 40 of his short stories have appeared in publications such as The Year's Best Military and Adventure SF, Year's Best Hardcore Horror, Terraform, Galaxy's Edge, Writers of the Future, Grimdark Magazine, Vestarian, and Abyss and Apex, among others. So you've... I see several things there that could lead to that story. But anyway, anything that like led to your doing the writing the darker storylines?
So there's a number of things. So, in terms of like Adramelech specifically, I grew up as in the Roman Catholic faith, mm-hmm. which, is very, I think the scariest movie I've ever seen is The Exorcist, because it really plays on that, that faith with the rites and the sure. demonology and things like that. Yeah. So that's part of the horror, the darker bent, right? In terms of kind of the, some of it's somewhat pessimistic, and I'm in Gen X, I'm a member of Gen X, and my generation has lived through a lot of crazy things. So I'll just walk you through me personally. So when I was a lieutenant in the U.S. Army, September 11th happened. I was a captain when we invaded Iraq. Following that, I got out of the Army, went to business school, went to the Kennedy School of Government. After that, I became an investment banker right around when the financial crisis happened. So, I got through the, you get through the financial crisis, and, you kind of rebuild and save and kind of do the right thing. And then, you end up in, kind of this, this global pandemic, right? Like 100-year, it's like a once in 100-year sort of event. Like my great grandfather, right, was the last time we had the, the influenza, the Spanish flu back in 1917, 1918. In fact, I think he may have contracted it when he was on a ship in the Navy. As he was like taking, conveying soldiers across the Atlantic Ocean. He got really sick. They didn't know what it was. He lost 15 pounds. And it was right during the first outbreak of equine flu. So there's a lot of things that, the baby boomer generation, aside from the Vietnam War, it kind of everything was up and to the right. Whereas, kind of Generation X, and probably to a tougher extent, the millennial generation, they just can't catch a break. So, a lot of it is just my reaction to that. And, at the end of the day, there's still that dogged determination, even in something as dark as Adramelech, right? It's all about free will. It's not like the circumstances you're in. It's not the fact that you're in those circumstances. It's how you behave in those circumstances, mm-hmm. and how you carry yourself on the other side of it. How resilient you are. And, a lot of the themes in my stories are very, very dark things happen. And sometimes things don't always end well. So even with that experience, I had a good friend who the anthology is dedicated to. And his name is Jay Harding. I went to high school with him. And I was, reunited with him when we were in the same unit in the U.S. Army, which was the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment. And the last time I saw him was, July or August of 2003. And then I never saw him again because the unit deployed to Iraq and he was killed by a suicide bomber. And he was the best of us. And, you know, the experience of my generation is, you know, it's been, I would say, a little bit rougher than the generation before us, but certainly not as tough as the, you know, the greatest generation, the one that fought World War II and survived through the Depression.
Right.
So, you know, it's a long answer to a pretty simple question, but I would say those are all the influences that have given my stories a little bit of a darker tint.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I think with this interview, I'd like to go in that direction a bit too, on just the subject of the darker side, the darker fantasy, dark, you know, the horror stuff. Because you've got a book, Weird World War III, and you sent it to me, and I very much appreciate that. And I was able to read some of the different, you know, descriptions of the stories and take a look at who wrote it and what the whole premise of the book was. And it's fascinating. I mean, one, I was really happy as well as being impressed that you've got C.L. Cagney, Stephen Lawson, Marina J. Lostetter, Martin Shoemaker, Eric James Stone, Brad Horgeson, and Brian Trent, all winners of the competition, Writers of the Future, as well as Mike Resnick, who was a judge and an amazing supporter of this, as well as his own editor of Galaxy's Edge, with a story in there. And then obviously having this be, as we were talking about, this is your first project as an editor. So first of all, let's talk about the book itself, because I think it's just a fascinating subject, Weird World War III, because there's a that line of actuality that runs through it, even though it's like the weird side of it. It's not. It's things that are there that you can look at a little bit further and decide that, is that for real? And then make your own decision on it once you go on it. So what sparked this?
So in terms of the idea, I always wanted to do an anthology, and I've always been interested in, you know, the Cold War and the relationship between, you know, the United States and the Soviet Union. And in the very beginning of, you know, after graduating from college, and even in college, there were, you know, influences that I had that really made me interested in, you know, again, I was in ROTC, so I, you know, joined the Army. And in growing up, I read books like Team Yankee by Howard, I think Tom Coyle, Red Army by Ralph Peters, Red Storm Rising by Tom Clancy. I was always interested in these large conventional battles, right? Mm-hmm. And when I was in the military, it was at the tail end of the, you know, as the Cold War had ended, and we were in this weird, and we're still to some extent there, we transitioned from a bipolar to a multipolar world, but we still, you know, our primary peer competitor at the time was Russia. And, you know, as a result, we, you know, my role at the National Training Center was to train U.S. forces before they went to war. And we did that by having these massive war games, 5,000 soldiers in an area the size of the state of Rhode Island in the Mojave Desert. And I became an expert on Soviet doctrine and tactics because that was the best thing we had. So I became intimately familiar with that side of things, to the extent that even after business school, one of my friends who grew up in the Republic of Georgia, his parents were trapped there when the Russians invaded in 2008. And he called me and he said, Sean, like, how do I, like, my parents are trapped there. How do I get them out? And, you know, I knew enough about how they fought that I knew what they were going to do. I told him, you know, which roads they take. I told him which targets they'd go after, which airfields they seize, which ports they block. And he called me 2 weeks later, and, you know, I'm not going to repeat it for the podcast, but, you know, he said, Sean, insert epithet, like, how, you know, how the F did you know what they were going to do? And I said, look, because they did exactly what you said they were going to do. And I said, I used to fight like them and I could read a map. So all that, you know, I wanted to, you know, put something together there, but I also wanted to add that horror aspect, or that weird fiction aspect. So think of like an, you know, H.P. Lovecraft or a Clark Ashton Smith. And the way that I conceived of the anthology is, think H.P. Lovecraft meets Tom Clancy. And that's kind of how, you know, how it went. And then what I wanted to do is I wanted to get some, you know, military science fiction authors, but also some weird authors. So on the military science fiction side, David Drake, who is very likely the, in addition to, L. Ron Hubbard, right, the, grandfather of military science fiction.
Yeah.
So, and he was also, by the way, in the regiment. He was in the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment. He fought in, Vietnam and Cambodia. I think on that alone, the fact that we were both, alumni of the Black Horse, he got involved. That's kind of the one end on the science fiction side. And Brad Torgerson obviously fits in that category as well. To the other extreme, which is kind of the weird fiction side, and that's the, Bram Stoker award winner, John Langan, who writes an amazing Lovecraftian story where he has, it's at the very end because, one of the paradigms for doing an anthology is start strong and long. Mm-hmm. And he writes extremely long stories. So he has, kind of like an 8,000 word story or 10,000 word story, something like that, at the end, called Second Front. And it's about cosmonauts and astronauts on the surface of the moon, staring on, at Earth, which had just survived a nuclear, but was in the aftermath of a nuclear conflict. And then there's a, Lovecraftian beastie that starts going after the cosmonauts, and the Americans have to decide what they want to do. Do they just watch it? Are these things going to come after them afterwards? So it's a really deliciously creepy story, and it's just done in the way that only John Langan can do it. And then you also have, kind of the T.C. McCarthy, who's a Bane author. And he's got an interesting story. It's actually a funny one too. I don't want to give too much away. And then you have, the Sarah Hoyts of the world, where, she, addresses something that I didn't even know was, may have been a real thing, which is remote viewing. And, that kind of, even after doing the anthology, that took me down a research spiral that I still can't get out of because it's so interesting. That's a bit of the inspiration, and I don't know if it's ever been done before, but I hope people really enjoy it. The other thing that's interesting about it is when I pitched it, my goal was actually to have it come out literally right before the election because there was still this, this Russian stuff in the manipulating elections and things like that, which I'm actually surprised that people are surprised by that. I mean, that's everybody does that. Right. Like every government does that. Right. Yeah. It's what you do to your enemy. It's not like they're, I'm sure we do the same thing. So, but I knew that I wanted to have it come out right then. And it just turns out the timing worked out perfectly.
Which is great. Yeah. And then, this could be the primer for, Sun Tzu's book.
Yeah.
The Art of
exactly.
War. This
exactly.
is nothing new about that at all. So that's just fascinating. And on this remote viewing you're talking about, like I said, I'm very interested in contacting some of these other paranormal stations because it's not an odd topic in the least. And there's a lot of people and there's a lot of other research and material on that subject. So I think this is great that you've talked about this, and we can see what we can do also on just introducing you to a whole new set of potential fans for you. That'd be great.
I'd love to learn more and who knows, right? Like it's just there are declassified government documents that talk about programs that the U.S. had, and are those declassified documents misinformation? Maybe, but mm-hmm. I doubt it. They're likely real. Did the program, how effective was it? The government, when they shut it down, did whatever they could to delegitimize it. And that could have been right. But sometimes
right.
the government does that. Sometimes they, it means that something's working pretty well and they want to keep it, working well and not have a lot of people look at it. So
exactly.
Anyway, again, I haven't done extensive research, so I don't know what's true and what's not, but I think it's a fascinating topic to learn more about.
Indeed it is. So as a writer, so you said you've had no problem on writing the more on the nonfiction or technical side of writing that you could just whip out essays and stuff. You could do things, but then it takes a little bit more on writing a story. So how'd you get started as a writer? How'd your own particular path take you?
So it all began in fifth grade. I had an assignment with a teacher. Her name was Mrs. Umile. And we just had to write a story. So I wrote one story, and you know, it was a fantasy story, just a, you know, nothing too imaginative about it, you know, kind of a sword and sorcery sort of piece. And then I started writing sequels to it, and then writing sequels to that, and then writing other stories. And, you know, it at that point, it didn't really go anywhere, but it was something that was, you know, always in the back of my mind. And then, you know, I also read a lot. So before high school, I was, you know, was reading The Hobbit. I read, you know, Red Army, you know, kind of seventh or eighth grade, you know, a lot of those books that I talked about earlier.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the, you know, Robert Jordan series, Wheel of Time, I really got into kind of in college. I was reading Game of Thrones, not quite when it came out in 96, but, you know, kind of 2000, something like that. And I really got into that. And then in the Army, I started an attempt at writing a novel. And it was a kind of sword and sorcery novel. I created an entire world with an economic system, countries, you know, militaries, how the militaries operated. I went into really, really fine detail. But I didn't know anything about the business side of it. I didn't know how people sold stories. I was just flailing in the dark. So I never really finished that that effort. But again, I just kind of put it in the back of my head. Went to graduate school, you know, did all the things I did there. And then, well, actually, so went to graduate school, did all the things I did there. You know, worried about just making a living, you know, had a number of different jobs, family, getting things started. And then, you know, in 2009, the financial crisis, you know, it things like that make you reassess what makes you happy and, you know, what it is you really want to do if you could do anything. And, you know, the economics of the business are still, it's a tough business.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like anything else. The distribution for authors, it's a power law distribution. So, you know, you may have heard of like a Pareto distribution where, you know, in Italy, 20% of the people own 80% of the land. It's much more skewed, I think, in the publishing industry. So you have, you know, some authors who are just, you know, like J.K. Rowling and George R.R. Martin, who are just, you know, raking in the dough, right, are doing extremely well. But, you know, they're probably the top, you know, 1% or less, and they're probably earning 80% of the spoils in the industry. So it's, you know, if you're supporting a family, it's one of those things that you have to be resilient. We go back to that theme of resilience, because you're gonna get a lot of rejections. And you just have to really like what you write, and you have to write because you want to write. And part of writing for me is just exercising those demons. And it's therapeutic for me, but it's also the power, like it's the power of creation, and being able to create things is something that, you know, you have something and it just didn't exist before. Just looking at that book, right? That was the idea. To do that specific concept is something that I pitched to Bain. And, you know, I pitched to the authors first because I had a roster of authors before I pitched to Bain, because otherwise, why would they, you know, who's this Sean Hazlett schmuck that we want to, you know, go with, right? No, I mean, look, I'm not like, you know, I'm a proven short story author. And even then there are certain achievements that I haven't unlocked yet, but I've never, you know, I'm a completely unproven editor. And so you have to have a hook that not only has authors that will interest readers who write great stories, but you also have to have a concept or a hook that is consistent with the brand of the publisher that you're pitching to. So, you know, as you know, military science fiction is right down the middle in terms of what Bain looks at. And to be completely honest, I pitched another concept before that was rejected. And, you know, it was a concept that wasn't, it was kind of like, you know, sort of interesting, but wasn't right down the middle.
Right.
And the one thing that I want to credit, I know I'm kind of hitting a bunch of areas, but we talked about Mike Resnick earlier on in the podcast. And when I asked him, I solicited a story from him for the first one. He, you know, the piece of advice is like, what's, if they turn you down, what's your next idea? and then your next one. So, you know, having that guidance was instrumental because, you know, you don't have to be rude about it. If you get rejected, you say, thank you very much. You don't complain. You don't argue a rejection. But the way you handle a rejection is extremely important because you can always go back. So the same publisher, Bain, that I'm doing this work with, I submitted a novel to, and they, you know, they seriously considered it for, you know, it was kind of there for like 2 years, and they ultimately didn't go with it. And, you know, was I upset? Of course I was upset. But, you know, how did I handle it? Thank you for taking your time to consider my novel. Is there anything that, you know, I could do that, you know, might make you more willing to consider it, or is this kind of, you know, the final judgment? And, you know, I forget what they said, but, and, you know, you thank them and that's it. And by doing that, you're establishing that you're a professional and that, you know, people can work with you. And I think that also helped. They knew who I was based on that interaction. Like I was close, but I wasn't close enough.
Mm-hmm.
But that the way that you handle, you know, tough situations, and having the mark of resilience really makes all the difference.
That's a very good point on that. It's a, one's business etiquette, you know, you can get for the acute upset if you decide to share it with your potential editor or publisher, is just going to guarantee that they will never be your publisher or editor.
That's exactly right. Like, look, they know you're upset. Like,
yeah,
you don't need to share that. They know you're upset. Like, it's your babe.
Yeah.
But you know, you're just some guy, right? Like, you're not like everybody can't be, you know, there's only a set number of slots that these folks can publish. So you just, you know, you take the lesson and you just improve the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. Mm-hmm. You don't quit.
Yeah.
Right. Cause again, the only, you know, the thing that makes you a writer is you didn't quit.
Yeah.
Kevin, it's that simple.
Yeah. Kevin Anderson, who is one of the most successful science fiction writers out there right now. I mean, he brags about it. He reckons he's got more rejects than anybody else. He keeps a big jar with all of his reject slips in it.
And oh, I bet you I beat him. I bet you I beat him.
Yeah.
Well, he's got a break over 2,000 to hit me.
Okay, well, I'm not going to go into...
he might, though. He might. He probably does. But
anyway, this was like 20 years ago. He was like 800 or so. So maybe it is, maybe not. But anyway, the point of that analogy is that you got to persist, in that every writer goes through that. You know, there's nobody that doesn't go through it. Even if it's just something as simple as it was a great story, just wrong day to go because they just bought a story like that, or you just need to keep on building, honing your craft to where you are that quality that you can be, like you said, your J.K. Rowling or your Stephen King or George R.R. Martin. I mean, even with Brandon Sanderson, one of our contest judges, when I talked to him, I was a guest lecturer at his creative writing class at BYU a few years ago, and this is when we got him on board as a judge. He was telling me that he had written, I think, 5 or 6 novels they'd submitted, none of them had been approved, and he was ready to quit. And when he submitted to Writers of the Future and got a finalist, it gave him that vote of encouragement of like, okay, don't quit. And it was like about 4 or 5 months later that he sold his first novel. So he was ready to throw in the towel because it's just, you know, rejection after rejection. You can get, you know, it can get on you. It can get into your skin. And you just need to know. And that's one thing that's really about Writers of the Future, with the forum, this podcast, the blogs that people who go to, they'll find out that they're not unique in their position of being rejected for the 10th time or 15th time or 20th time. So they know it's blind judging and everybody has an equal opportunity. There's no,
yep, yep.
Nothing. It's either it's a good story or it's not. And so anyway.
And that's what I love about it. It is a true meritocracy. Like there's no, you know, you are judged solely based on the quality of your story and nothing else.
Yeah.
Because there's no other information you have to judge it upon. So, I really like that aspect of it. And the fact that just the discipline that it instills,
yeah,
right, it encourages you. I was about to say force, but you force yourself.
Yeah.
You force yourself to write at least, you know, a story a quarter. And that's a good discipline to have. And it really helps you experiment with, different sorts of stories and you just see what works and what doesn't, because you get feedback too. Even if you don't win getting an honorable mention. I think the first serious story I ever wrote and submitted got an honorable mention. And I was pretty naive back then when I submitted. But my view was, if I don't do well in this contest in my first submission, then I'm not meant to do this, which is a terrible attitude to have, right? As you know,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You know, because you get hundreds to thousands of rejections, over during the course of a career. But I got an honorable mention the first time, and it really encouraged me to push forward. And I'm not sure if I would have pushed forward without that nudge, because I had no idea. I had no idea how good or bad the quality of my writing was. No idea.
Yeah.
And it was a good way to validate that just to get an external validation of something that I didn't know if I was, good or not. And again, I've always considered myself a good writer,
uh-huh.
but writing fiction is a completely different muscle than business writing or academic writing. I still find it much more challenging than, I could bang out an article very quickly, or I can bang out an email that's very clear, concise, and creates movement and action very easily.
Mm-hmm.
But, writing a good story that somebody enjoys, and getting the language right, and the number of drafts that you have to do, and just, I go over and over and over, and still it might not sell. And sometimes the story's just not, it just doesn't work, and there's nothing. But there's little you can do to fix it. So, everything that I write, I put it through, half a dozen to a dozen revisions before I send it out. And sometimes you sell and sometimes you don't. And sometimes you sell something that you thought was okay. And sometimes you don't sell things you thought were outstanding. It's kind of, even this, at this stage in my career, it's still tough to judge my own writing and what's good and what's not.
Well, one thing that also adds a little hits to that as well, it might be an awesome story, but the editor just bought a story like that in the last issue, and he's not interested in that story anymore. Or
yep.
What happened once, Dave Farland said, one time he had three werewolf stories, which are great stories, in 1 year. He can only buy one. He can only choose one for the book, and the other two he just had to say no because I'm only going to do one werewolf. So it's that's another thing that you have to realize too, that, and this is where the Heinlein rules come in. You got to keep on sending it out until it sells. You can't
that's
stop
right.
sending it out, because it might also be just a guy has a bad hair day happening today, and you just drew the bad card that he's. He sees your story on his bad hair day, and so everything got sent out. But if he would have seen it the next day, he said, "Oh, this is pretty good," because he's got a different attitude. So it's just, there's a lot of the luck of the draw as well. So there, it's just a matter of continuing to send a story out. If you think it's a good story, then keep on sending it out until the editor says, "Okay, I like it, but do this and this and this," in which case you do it. But otherwise, keep on shopping it until it sells. That's just, it's part of the thing. The exception to the rule is a person that sells first off. That is such an exception to the rule that it gives one a misconception of what publishing can be and what it should be, and it's not what it is.
There's a quote that I used in my admissions essay to one of the schools that I applied to by Johann von Goethe. It's, "Censor does much, but encouragement does more. Encouragement after censor is like the sun after a shower." And it's just true. That's kind of what the contest is, right? You get more negative feedback from, just all the other submissions that you do. And just having that one piece of encouragement amidst, a sea of rejection is what can, is the one thing that spurs you to fight on.
Yeah.
Unless you're like me, which is like the more rejections make me even angrier, so I fight even harder. But I'm a, you've read a drama like, so I'm a little bit, I'm a little different animal.
But for people of the similar genus of animal, So in terms of writing horror fiction, because I haven't talked to really anybody about that, any particular tips you would give or advice either on research or on tone or the sense of hopelessness, or what about it makes it so interesting to people? What's the big draw that people have to it, but then also how to go about, you know, producing it?
So in terms of what the draw is there's this, so you get a, there's like a, there's a vicarious thrill that you get from it. So there was a University of Chicago study. There's a Guardian article that was out in the last, you know, month or two. And there was a University of Chicago study that said that people who were horror fans were like post-apocalyptic fans were better able to, you know, or showed more resilience during this current pandemic because they've been reading horror, and because when you read horror, you actually rehearse worst case scenarios, right? Which is also kind of what I did in the military. So by preparing for something that's absolutely, you know, terrible and extremely unlikely to happen because you're dealing with, you know, things that don't exist, like literally don't exist, you're able to handle the tough things that happen in your life that are not as bad as that, right? It also just prepares you mentally. It's the same thing the way we would prepare soldiers mentally. So when I was at the National Training Center, we would always win. I think there was one battle out of 100 that I remember losing. I'm not going to say the unit because I don't want them to get cocky, but they beat us bad. It was embarrassing, but I think we beat ourselves, to be honest, and they just took advantage of it. But we always win, and the reason we would always win is because we wanted to expose what their weaknesses are so that they could shore them up before they actually encountered the enemy. Because, you know, the enemy's got a vote, and you can have the best laid plans. So, you know, in terms of the psychological piece, it gives people that vicarious thrill without the actual real world damage. And there's also an intellectual component. It's just kind of interesting to see how human beings react to things that are unreal, things that they don't expect. And the one thing I actually I've always struggled with is I've never read a story that scared me. Never. And I don't know why that is. I don't know if that's something about me. And it's something like if I don't know how a story reads that scares me, how do I make a story that scares somebody else? So you mentioned also the atmosphere. And that's the other thing I really enjoy. So some of the authors that, you know, again, these are, you know, much, much older authors, but authors that, well, actually there'd be some contemporaries that are really good for reading atmosphere in terms of, you know, in horror and cosmic horror, like H.P. Lovecraft obviously is one. People have accused him of having purple prose, but I think, I think that's a good start. There's also Algernon Blackwood, again, really good atmospherics, the same thing with H.P. Lovecraft, Clark Ashton Smith. Those are kind of some of the greats that have that kind of dark atmosphere. And of course the granddaddy of them all, right? Edgar Allan Poe is also an excellent writer to read. In terms of more contemporary authors, John Langan is one for sure. And he's in World War III, as well as Laird Barron is also another really kind of dark writer. There's Thomas Ligotti, right? So there, you mentioned Dysterion, which is a literary journal that's has fiction that's similar to Thomas Ligotti. And that's kind of, you know, if you've ever seen the first episode or the first season of True Detective, yeah. There's a lot of Ligottian elements there. Right. And there's also, you know, you can go even further back. There's a lot of references to Carcosa, which is the Yellow King. And that's, I think like Robert W. Chambers was, you know, kind of in the, you know, at the, you know, turn of the last century was writing a lot of, he wrote about a play that if you went to see the play, you would go mad. And it was infectious and like really, really, really interesting ideas that were also, very, very dark.
Right.
So in terms, and there's also different styles in the genre, right? So there's something that I don't really gravitate toward because I think it's just less interesting. There's something called splatterpunk, right, which is just, you know, and body horror and things like that, which is you know, very sort of graphic stuff that's not my cup of tea. Mine's more atmospheric. You just kind of things that happen, but you don't describe every little thing, right?
Yeah.
Just by describing elements of what's coming at you from just beyond the campfire, right? And just seeing aspects of it. But you know, if you kind of describe the whole thing in extreme detail, you kind of lose some of the effect.
Yeah.
So, and I feel like the genre is actually, it's, you know, in the past, it's kind of been the bastard stepchild of fantasy and science fiction. But I think in recent years, I think it's come to more prominence. And I think it also had a really big heyday in the 80s. So it's one of those things that it's kind of a feature, I would think. I don't think it's necessarily its own thing. I think it's going to be a feature of a fantasy story or a feature of a science fiction story. So, you know, there are a number of, you know, different ways. In terms of writing, you know, there's a book by Stephen King called, I think it's called On Writing.
It is.
And it's not just a good primer. It's not really, I wouldn't even say it's a good primer for horror. It's just a good primer for writers in general. But I also wouldn't overdo it, right? There's a lot of, there are certain things that people talk about, like never use adverbs, limit the adjatives. What's the other piece that they always talk about? Don't use passive voice. And I think those are good rules to learn when you're beginning. But I think you become a great writer when you learn when it's okay to break those rules, right? So just as an example, so in the military, right, we were trained rigorously to use active voice. And the reason we were trained that way is if you're in a war or you're in combat and somebody says the hill will be taken by 4 p.m., who do you think is going to take that hill? Right? Nope.
Yeah.
So you have to be very clear and very direct. But in fiction, you can do character development by, you know, having a really effective way to build characterization is if I read a speech tag or if I read some dialogue, I know exactly who the person speaking is without a speech tag. I just know by the way they talk. And you can use passive voice in that way by, you know, you could have a passive character or a character who's not on the level, right? Somebody who's not direct, somebody who's indirect, somebody who's operating from the shadows and speaks that way. He or she speaks using, a higher percentage, 50, you know, higher percentage of passive voice than anybody else. And again, it's a small technique, but, when you read books like the Stephen King's On Writing, you also have to be cognizant of that. Because there's also, I think, in today's day and age, is there's an overemphasis on kind of like Hemingway style of writing, where every word, you know, carries a particular weight, right? And it's moving away from kind of that Lovecraftian writing that people, you know, there's some people who think it's utter dreck. There are other people who think that it's exceptionally well written, but there's a lot, you know, there's just a lot of purple prose. And, you know, I kind of gravitate more toward that Lovecraftian, sort of, it's the kind of writing I like, but I also, sometimes it can, when I put my editing hat on, I have to cut that down. I have to cut it down a lot.
Yeah.
So, but I certainly, like, I would never write like a, you know, something as terse as a Hemingway, right? It's just not like that. That's not enough for me.
Yeah. Well, that's good. And that definitely helps on that. Now, how did you find out originally about Writers of the Future?
So I think when I started, I know exactly how. I was actually thinking about this all day. I'm like, how did I figure that out? So when I started submitting fiction, there's a website called Duotrope where you can log, you know, where all the places where you can find what the markets are. I don't know if it was Duotrope or it was Ralin or Raylan, whatever it's called. But there was it was one of those sites that had lists of different publications that I could submit to, because I had, you know, I had little idea. I know about the like three, you know, analog Asimovs and fantasy and science fiction, but I didn't really know much about anything else.
Right.
So when I started going through that, I, you know, investigated Writers of the Future, and I'm like, oh, this is like, what's the catch? Like, this is phenomenal. Like, I can enter, it doesn't cost me anything. And, you know, I can, you know, I can win this massive award, be published in, you know, an anthology, and, you know, go down to Hollywood for, you know, an award ceremony and meet, influential authors in the business, like Tim Powers and editors, authors like, David Farland and Mike Resnick. And that's kind of the initial entree. And then there is a website that is run by the Writers of the Future, where there are other aspirants who log on. And I believe at one point Brad Ferguson was running it, but that's
he's still one of the people on the forum on writersofthefuture.com, the Writers of the Future forum.
That's right.
Yeah, he still helps out in there.
Yeah, the forum. I think every once in a while I'll go back, and I think there's one thread that just won't die. I'll post something to make sure it doesn't die. but all of us are on there. Like, you know, I think I probably started writing about a year after Martin Shoemaker did. And that's how I got to know Martin. It's how I got to know Brad. I mean, and there's some of these authors that I still haven't met in real life. Like, I haven't met Brad in real life. I've met Martin in real life. I've met, you know, Marina in real life. I've met a ton of people on that forum, but it gave me, it was just helpful to see everybody going through a similar journey, and, you know, all of us, and it wasn't a, like, you know, I come from, you know, very competitive, a very competitive background, right? Where, you know, in business, you know, there's, in some cases, not all, but in many cases, it's a zero-sum game, and this can be ruthless. This is a very different feeling from that. Like, everybody was out to support each other. And, you know, you look at some of the authors who are on that one particular thread, and, you know, a lot of them have novels coming out and have anthologies coming out. So you have, you know, Martin's published, you know, has had tremendous success. Brad's had, you know, great success. You know, both, you know, Bane authors, but also I think Martin has some stuff from 47 North. You also, you know, there, you know, also, I think Andrea Stewart, she's got a book that just came out this month and is getting amazing reviews. So, you know, just looking at that, you know, it's kind of the common, one of those common connections between the generation before us and the next generation of writers. Right. There's a lot of continuity there. Right. So, you know, Mike Resnick, I would consider him to be like a writer dad, as, you know, as Martin would, and
so many other writers considered him that.
But like the anthology you saw, like, that wouldn't have happened. You know, there's a much lower chance that would have happened if Mike didn't just, you know, I knew better to have another idea, but I currently, you know, didn't have it up my sleeve yet, but he gave me that little nudge. I'm like, okay, yeah, I'll put together another pitch. And, you know, when the first one didn't make it, you know, it's entirely due to him that I made another submission. And as a result, you know, that you see that idea that just formed in my head, is now a real thing, and it's a real thing that's going to, you know, come out next month. In terms of the contest, and then again, I told you that, you know, earlier in our discussion about the first time I submitted, you know, I had this really rigid criteria. Like, if it's just flat out rejected, I'm not suited for this. Right. It's a terrible attitude. Like, no writer should have that attitude, but, I got lucky, you know, and then that's the other thing. That's the one thing I also didn't acknowledge, right? There's, and you've actually indirectly alluded to it, right? What if a writer, you write a perfectly good story, but they have to reject it because, you know, there's three werewolf stories and yours is number three, right? So there's a huge element of luck in all this, and you just have to acknowledge it, and you have to get comfortable with it. Because it's, you know, and given it's luck, it's like playing soccer, right? The more shots you take on goal, the higher, you know, the more likely you are to hit one.
That's right.
And that's the way it works. Now, are you going to be a, you know, New York Times bestselling author? Maybe, maybe not. You have to also do it because you love to do it, because you have this urge to create that you can't stifle anywhere, you know, any way else. So, anyway, okay. I think it's a great contest, and I think I would encourage lots of people to enter it, because it puts your name on the map.
Yeah.
It makes people aware of you.
Indeed, it does. Now, part of the obviously the contest was created by L. Ron Hubbard. He was himself a major writer in the 30s and 40s, and then he celebrated his 50th anniversary with Battlefield Earth. Any particular comments about the essays that he wrote that were part of the workshop, or stories that he's written that perhaps you've read?
Yeah, so there's a story that was in volume 33 called The Devil's Rescue, and it's his take on the Flying Dutchman legend. And when I first read it, it still works today. Like, for something that was written, you know, I don't know exactly when it was written, right? But it was, it's if you need a good example of something that you just, of reading a story where you just can't put the book down, he has a talent for that. Even in, there was a novel that he came out with called Final Blackout, which was, I think it came out in kind of right around the Sitzkrieg or right after, when the Germans, kind of invaded France.
Yeah.
The novel kind of saw, it was kind of a prelude to Einstein's comment that, you know, I don't know what weapons will be used to fight World War III, but I know that World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones, right? That it just starts right with the stick, you know, kind of in the sticks and stones part, right?
Yeah.
But just, you know, before the atom bomb, right? Before, you know, you would have known about, you know, some of the experiments and things like that and the theory, but the world didn't know about the power of the atom bomb until, you know, like 1945, when we, you know, dropped two on Japan. But he kind of saw beyond that, right, in terms of atomic wars and you know, what would be left after that, and the plagues and pestilence after that. And not only that, also a part about being in the military, right, which is, I believe L. Ron Hubbard was a naval officer.
Yes.
Right? So he understood I'm going to go on a bit of a tangent here, but there was there are two psychologists. I think their names is Shills and Janowitz. And what they did after World War II is they wanted to understand why the German soldier fought for, you know, a fanatical regime, for the Nazi regime. Like, what drove them to, you know, continue to give their lives and fight? And what they learned is they established a theory called primary groups. And when you interview soldiers, you know, they're not fighting for their president. They're kind of tangentially, they are fighting for their country, but that's not really what the primary driver is. The primary driver is it's the man and woman to your left and to your right, and, you know, making sure that they get through it. And that's one of the fundamental themes of that book, which is timeless.
Yeah.
Right. You it's kind of this, kind of Celtic idea, right? You don't follow your leader because he's your leader. You follow your leader because you've chosen him and because you want to follow him.
Yeah.
Because he cares about you, because he's going to take care of you, and he's going to make sure that, you know, you're going to survive and you're going to end up on the positive side of any engagement that you're in. And I think that's what that particular novel captures very well.
But absolutely is correct there. Yeah, and when Orson Scott Card read it, he's got the introduction he wrote that's coming out in the new edition of that, which, by the way, was written in 1940, so it's 60 years old this year. But
yeah, it's amazing, and even the use of language in the first chapter, and just the kind of talking about the way the world has been shaped. Mm-hmm. Beyond all these wars, it's extremely well written, extremely evocative.
Yeah. So anyway, so he was, as the as the author of both these stories, you talked about the one, the novel, and the one short story. Any, you know, comment on that in terms of the writers of the future itself, how that maybe qualified him, or just your take on that and just being able to take the direction or what the contest has to offer for the aspiring writer?
So, number one, it gives you a schedule and a deadline to force yourself to start something and to finish it. Number two, it doesn't cost you anything, and it, other than time. And the upside is that you know, your name gets known, and it leads to other opportunities. Because at the end of the day, you're dealing with a business, you know, as well as an art. And you know, if any editor has the choice between somebody who's unknown and Stephen King, they're always going to pick Stephen King because Stephen King's going to sell more. So the sooner that you get your name out there as a known quantity makes the rest of the journey a little bit easier. For that reason, but also just because the more you write, the better you get. And yeah, the better you get, the more you're going to sell.
That's right.
And then, and again, I want to, like, you know, caveat, there's also, you know, there are no guarantees, right? Luck can be a bit capricious at times. And you have to just acknowledge to yourself that you're doing this because you love it. And if you hit it out of the park, great. If you don't, well, it is what it is. Yeah. But at least you've created. You have to do it because you want to create, not because you want to, become a George R. R. Martin. That's a nice thing to have.
Yeah. But there is a lot of sales to be had out there. And I think the main thing on this, the main moral of this whole story is the persistence and not giving up, not quitting. And that's one thing that the contest, as created by Mr. Hubbard, was to provide that helping hand, but also provide that encouragement so that you don't give up. You know, you keep on going. And the worst that's going to happen when you enter the contest is you get an email saying, thank you very much for your entry. You didn't make it, but please submit again. There's no judging. There's no anything. Just like, keep going. Don't give up. And and that's
you're not going to be a writer if you quit.
That's right. That's right. A writer writes, and you have to keep on writing and writing and writing. I know that Mr. Hubbard said, but also Jerry Purnell, one of our earlier judges who passed away a few years ago, you know, throw away your first million words. You've got to write. You got to keep on doing it and doing it and doing it. And then also to your point on the rules in Stephen King's book on writing, one of the pieces of advice that Jerry Purnell gave was, you got to start with the rules. Once you've mastered the rules and mastered your craft, then you can go ahead and start breaking the rules. But then you know that you're breaking the rules. You're not doing it because you don't know. You're doing it now because you're intentionally doing it to create a certain purpose, a certain effect that, you know, is a way to be able to accomplish that effect. But to start with, you know, breaking the rules because you don't know what they are, learn the rules, play by the rules, and once you get good enough, then you can start playing with them.
That's right. And I actually, the first and last time I met him was at the, the contest.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So he's, as you know, he was also a former military officer.
That's right.
So when I told him I was too, and he just, like, he wouldn't stop talking. I mean, it was great. it was fantastic.
He totally respected, you know, military, as did Mr. Hubbard. He was, he was more so the enlisted man, you know, and the non-com, yeah, and that, rather than the generals and the admirals and the ones that didn't necessarily make the right calls, you know, because of the way they were appointed, not because of successful operations, but because they could, like he says, they could drink more wine, more champagne, and smile better than someone else, you know, to get their appointments. He was definitely disillusioned with some of the leaders over the military when...
And that shows in Final Blackout.
Yeah, for sure. It definitely shows in that. So, we've definitely talked a lot today, and I had several more questions, but I think we're about ready to call it quits on this one here, because it went in a direction I wasn't expecting, but I'm really glad that it did, because being able to talk about horror and that dark fantasy, I think, is so important that I've not had anybody talk to about that, and so this is a great new aspect to the podcast that we'll be able to offer to aspiring writers of the dark fantasy.
I'm glad to help.
Yeah. So how can people find you? Where do they go to find Sean Patrick Hazlett?
So I actually have a new website that I put together primarily because of the book launch. So it's seanpatrickhazlett@wordpress.com.
Great. And we'll put that also on the website itself when we post this. And then again, the book that is coming out in October?
That's right, October 6th. You can find it on just about anywhere. So Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Books A Million, Walmart, Powell's Books, Target, you know, anywhere books are sold.
That's awesome. I wish you all the best on that. And again, thank you very much for taking this time, Sean. And I'm going to just close off this podcast. To everybody else that's listening, thank you very much. Subscribe to the Writers of the Future podcast wherever you get your podcasts. The Writers of the Future podcast is available on SoundCloud, iTunes, Google Play, Pocket Casts, Stitcher, Player FM, iHeart, and Spotify. Writers and Illustrators of the Future are contests created by L. Ron Hubbard to provide a means for the aspiring writer and artist to be seen and acknowledged. It is free to enter and open to new and amateur short story writers and artists of science fiction or fantasy. Again, thank you very much, Sean. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me.